This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider.
Actor Ron Livingston has seen it all, working in comedy and drama and on TV, film, and stage. But like many viewers, he was floored by the Red Wedding episode of HBO's Game of Thrones, titled The Reigns of Castamere.
It's interesting that it's called Reigns of Castamere because the other thing that's kind of amazing about that episode is, in one way, the whole episode is about the lyrics to a song. Mm-hmm. And they introduce the song earlier in the episode, and then they, you know, you hear the song in the end credits of the episode, and the penny drop, the song itself plays a huge role in the. It's a plot point. It's a, you know, it's a denouement. It's so the fact that they could do that with a song was kind of incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that it did, you know, here we are towards the end of season three. It floored me when Ned Stark died.
Right, right. That's when they told you.
When Sean B. died in season one, that was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
All bets are off.
Bets are off. What are we watching? But you get lulled a little bit by the idea that, well, okay, well, they did that once. They can't do that again.
Can't shock you again.
And sure enough, in season three, they just sucker punched us with, we lost like 2/3 of the good guys. We're all of a sudden like gone, and it really sort of sends notice that it makes the world, which is supposed to be dangerous. You know, but it doesn't always feel dangerous in fantasy because you sort of know the good guy's going to win. Like Luke Skywalker, you know, he's in peril, but we know he's not actually in peril.
Right.
Not so Game of Thrones. You know what I mean? After that episode, you knew that nobody was safe in that show, ever.
I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the podcast, we talk to Loudermilk and A Million Little Things star Ron Livingston about his current series, his career choices, including that early appearance in the classic film Swingers, plus his favorite episode of TV of all time, that iconic Red Wedding moment on Game of Thrones. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode's about to start.
Episode.
Coming real, it's the next episode.
Ron Livingston can't be pigeonholed as one type of actor. He's perhaps still best known as Peter Gibbons in the cult classic Office Space, but he's also been seen on Band of Brothers and Boardwalk Empire, among dozens of other titles. He's been in romantic comedy, satire, drama, action, animation, thrillers, and just about every other kind of film, TV, or stage work imaginable. And he kind of likes it that way. Currently, Livingston can be seen in the AT&T Audience Network comedy Loudermilk and the ABC drama A Million Little Things. When IndieWire asked the actor to select his favorite episode of TV of all time, he picked an iconic one.
All right, so Ron, I asked you to pick your favorite episode of TV of all time.
Really hard question.
Yeah, there's
very hard to do.
You came back pretty fast, and you chose the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones.
I did. I thought about going like way back because I remember the All in the Family episode where Edith goes through menopause and. There's a Carol Burnett episode where they send up Gone with the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
I felt
very
like
famous.
None of your listeners would know what I was talking about.
you're showing your age at that point? Is that
in the last, say, 15, 20 years, that episode just really kind of sticks with me as what writing can be at its finest.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, acting and, you know, directing, the whole thing. But the story, it's just such a perfect little gem of an episode.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, the real title of the episode is The Reigns of Castamere, but
that's
we
right.
all just remember it as the Red Wedding episode
right.
now, just because
yeah.
it was so... It was the penultimate episode of season three and really a game changer. People who don't watch the show heard about the Red Wedding. Now, were you a Game of Thrones fan from the beginning? Or
yeah, I think I came into it in season two or I came into it in season two, binged season one and then caught up.
Yeah.
I got hooked to it. It's really well done.
Please, he is my son, my first son. Let him go, and I swear we will forget this. I swear it by the All Gods and you. We will take no vengeance.
You already swore me one oath right here in my castle. You swore by all the gods your son would marry my daughter.
Take me for a hostage, but let Rob go. Rob, get up. Get up and walk out! Please! Please!
And why would I let him do that?
What drew you to Game of Thrones? As a fan?
I was a big fan of J.R.R. Tolkien, all the Middle Earth stuff. Like kind of a crazy nerd about it, like way into it, and in a way, I didn't really read any other fantasy because I didn't think it measured up. And I feel like when Game of Thrones came along, I was primed to want to like it, and then sure enough, it really has a depth to it. The world is really compelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's most of it. Is that the world is really compelling, and the idea of the structure of we're gonna have all of these protagonists, and we don't know which one is the protagonist of the show. We're not gonna find out who the heroes that we're rooting for until the very end. So it's a little bit like a game of Survivor.
It's
a Game of Thrones.
Yes, really. Indeed. It is a dense show. It is hard. This is one of those shows where you can't watch with your laptop in your lap because you have to pay full attention.
Yeah.
So the complications of it over the years. I find that every year I have to go back and basically reread all the synopses of the previous season because I've forgotten.
It's hard to keep
so
it
much.
Up. Yeah. They do a great job, I think, with the previously on as far as like, oh, okay, that's what I needed to know to get through this next episode that I'm seeing. But no, I'm with you. I think at some point, before they come back, I'm going to have to – I don't know when I'm going to find the time to do that, but I got to go back and see some stuff again.
Too late to get on the show, unfortunately. They've wrapped, but there are spinoffs.
Yeah.
In case you ever want to work your way onto one of those.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
What did you watch as a kid? What were your favorite shows growing up?
I was a big fan of Hogan's Heroes. The Adam West Batman show was hands down my favorite show, I think from probably second grade on.
Yeah.
I still think it's a great, it's just the comedy in that. The sort of subversive, really dry... comedy in that was just something that I'd never seen that before.
Yeah,
that kind of arch campy. Like I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
The Carol Burnett Show was something that like I watched. I remember watching with my family, and just seeing your parents howling with laughter.
Yeah,
is a great fond memory that the show gives you. But yeah, man, there's been a lot of great shows. I was on board with Hill Street Blues, although I caught it in syndication. I didn't see it when it came out.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say a lot of these shows you probably caught the repeats in syndication
because
you're not that old.
No, I wasn't there for the
It's like 75-year-old Ron Livingston.
No, not quite.
No,
well, getting there, but not quite.
Not quite. So, but that's cool. You caught up on a lot of the classics.
And, yeah.
Was there any show in particular that sort of inspired you as a budding actor or something that convinced you like, yeah, that's what I want to do?
You know what? No, there's definitely a lot of shows that I ripped off over, you know. Like I'm gonna steal that. Uh-huh. That's just, you know what I mean? Like
that's a good tick or
that's
something.
That's a good something.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, but no, I can't say that I did. I mean, when I started, grew up in Iowa, so there was no quest. You couldn't be a professional actor in Iowa. I think there were 7 of them.
Yeah.
You know. And one of them would have to die for there to be a spot for another one.
Right, right.
And that's working on stage in Garrison, Iowa. So so it was like being on a softball team, you know. You're not going to be a professional fast-pitch softball player. But you can really enjoy. You can be the best, you know, playing in the church league or whatever. And acting, that's what acting was. It was, school productions and community theater productions. So I don't think it was later that it occurred to me that that this is something that maybe I could actually do.
Yeah, yeah. No, and by the way, Swingers happened to come out the same year I moved out to L.A., and I was at that age as well. So that's
right about the same,
still,
I got there maybe a year or two before you did. It was that was all of our stories. And that's the thing that's so amazing about that is that John had the, you know, the perspective and the wherewithal to be, you know, in a kind of big tumultuous shifting time of his life when he was, you know, going out and seeking his fortune, but to also see the comedy of it and to kind of just document it so specifically.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many little things in that it's a little bit when I watch that movie now, it's kind of like watching old home movies, you know, like old 8mm of you're running around through the sprinklers on the yard, because it's not so much character that you're playing. It's like, no, I'm watching myself at 20, 26, 27 years old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a moment in time. Mm-hmm. But Marty and Elaine are still at the Dresden Room.
They're still there.
That's pretty amazing.
God love them.
What would you say was your moment? What was your sort of, if there was a break or someone did something or even said something to you that put you on this path?
I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go.
Yeah.
I could go back to the 6th grade play. I could go back to the 9th grade play.
Uh-huh.
But if you're talking about in a, like as a like quote unquote professional.
Yeah.
Which is in quotes because you have to declare yourself a professional long before anyone actually pays you to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you're professional because you say so. I'd say Swingers was a big deal. There was a movie I did before Swingers called The Low Life, and nobody saw it, but it was still a big deal
because
it was I had a credit on a on a movie.
Well, what got you your SAG card? What was the
Straight
very first?
Talk?
Yeah,
yeah, Straight Talk with Dolly Parton and James Woods.
Wow,
had 3 lines, all 3 of them were cut, but I was still in the. I'm still sort of in the opening montage, dancing with Dolly Parton. And I think it was billed in order of appearance, so I feel like I got 2nd or 3rd billing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. It was good. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So that was she was like a talk show host, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so what did you...
She was a radio. She was like a radio host that was, you know, homespun wisdom. It was... I played a when we start off before she becomes a talk show the radio host, she's a dance like a ballroom dance instructor and we see a montage of just how challenging that job is and one of the snippets is I'm playing a soldier who's like just being kind of inappropriate and grabbing her and being inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
She's trying to put up with it.
Hashtag me too.
Hashtag me too, yeah, right. At the time, it's like, oh, this is our funny opener.
Right, right.
You know, that everybody can relate to, and I'm glad that we don't look at it that way anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Your very first role was you were a soldier.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
So not that there's continuity between that and, say, Band of Brothers.
Probably not. No, probably not.
Of course, people probably still ask you the most about Office Space, or is that still the one that pops
that's
up?
That's like the...
Like the civilians on the streets?
That was... That's I'm really proud of that movie. That's the one I think that's... it's just kind of lasted.
Mm-hmm.
The way it kind of built was sort of amazing. It was my first big... lead.
Yeah.
It was my first studio, and it was a studio lead, and it was so it was a big deal, that was a big deal. That's probably, I think, of any job that I ever quote unquote landed, that was the biggest fish that I probably still to this day, from where I was at before that job to having gotten that job.
Yeah.
It was a big one.
And to have worked with so many of these also sort of these talented creators who haven't been pigeonholed. Like when you look at Mike Judge's career and the things that he's done up until now, you can't just say he's the Beavis and Butthead guy. You can't.
No.
He's not one person, kind of like, Peter Farrelly now. So would you say, is there anything in particular that you took from that experience that you still use today?
I mean... the funny thing about that is it would seem that I'm a genius as far as picking extraordinarily gifted people to work with.
Just take it. Just say, yeah, you are.
Yeah. It's almost – I feel like it's a little bit – I kind of didn't fit neatly in any particular box as an actor. So I think I would only tend to get hired – by people who were already capable of thinking outside the box. And I think that's a part of the reason that, I got to be a part of a lot of extraordinary projects that were slightly innovative,
Yeah, and that's something I think I remember asking you about when we did ATX a couple years ago, and it still sort of holds true because right now you're in such different kinds of projects. And you've always been known as someone who can do comedy, who's done drama, who's done action, that's, I assume, has been a benefit to not be pigeonholed, that there hasn't been that's a Ron Livingston, he can only do one type of thing.
I mean, that was really important to me as I was coming up. I really didn't want to get stuck doing, multi-camera sitcom television forever.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is if you just want somebody to be funny, there's a lot of people that are a lot funnier than I am. Like they're everywhere. If you want somebody to be strikingly good looking, you're not gonna cast me for that. If you want somebody to be a villain, that's, you know what I mean? I'm never gonna work. So the kind of stuff that I would be able to get would be stuff where they needed a little bit of all of those things kind of intertwined.
Yeah.
And, and it's a blessing, really, because that's a lot of the most fun stuff to work on. But it did come, I think my career, my agents would scratch their heads because of the way you kind of rise to stardom is you do something really good, and then you do it again on a bigger platform for more money, and then you do it on the biggest platform for the most money. And so I think when they saw me kind of frog hopping around between now I want to, I've just cracked this comedy thing and I've got my foot in the door, and now I want to go do Band of Brothers, and I've just cracked this drama thing and I want to go do something else.
Yeah.
And it's... I'm sure there's a lot of projects that I could have got that I didn't get because I was doing that, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. You are a man of many platforms on television at this moment.
Yeah, it's been a busy October.
Yeah. So we see you on broadcast, of course, with A Million Little Things. We see you back on cable with season 2 of Loudermilk, and you even pop up on the Romanoffs.
Yes.
So you're doing a little streaming too. You're the triple threat right now. You're on all three platforms.
I got to diversify. So you got to make sure, you're on something somewhere.
Yeah, but nonetheless, it's this kind of the new way TV now is produced is allowing you to do multiple things kind of all at the same time.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the Wild West right now. I remember when I first started out in the 90s, you know, TV was very different. It was still the big three, and Fox was kind of the up and comer that was trying to. It was like a big deal that their big three might turn into a big four,
right?
You know,
and that was still the place to be. I mean, that was
But at the same time, the independent film came along, and all of a sudden, it kind of upended the movie side of things, and there was a lot of opportunity for people to kind of get in, and because there was a lot of experimentation going on,
yeah.
And I feel like a similar thing has happened in the last couple of years with television, where the business model just got turned on its ear, and all of a sudden there's a market for something that's different and, you know, kind of niche-y. And and the success is measured in all kinds of different Byzantine ways that we don't even really know if something's a hit anymore, because are we counting viewers? Or are we counting subscribers? Or are we counting, like, hits?
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of freeing to some degree, right? Now that you don't have to necessarily look at those numbers and just, you know, look at the long story, the long tail?
Yeah, I mean, the good news about it is I didn't I could look at them before, but it didn't mean anything, because it's not my side of the you know, camera.
Yeah.
I've always just tried to do stuff that's good and make it good, and that hasn't changed. But definitely the opportunities for things, there's more opportunities now, I think, than ever.
Yeah, and I think maybe the big difference for you is that in the past, if you were going to commit to a TV series, there was a chance that was a full-time gig, that, you know, 24 episodes.
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't have time to do much else other than during hiatus.
No, they own you. And, I mean, time or even energy to do something else, you know, because they worked you pretty hard. It's different. You know, Loudermilk, we do 10 episodes, and we work really fast. We do an episode every 4 days.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That is fast.
Yeah. It's and part of the reason that we can do that is that we block shoot it. Last year, we did all 10 episodes at once.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of constantly jumping around in the timeline. And that allowed us to, like, okay, when we're in the church basement, we're going to shoot all the church basement scenes for the entire series.
Yeah.
And when we go to the apartment, we're going to shoot all the apartment scenes for the entire series. And it's kind of a great way to do it, because you know it's, you know, the old school way was that if it was a movie, you knew the beginning and the middle and the end. And if it was a TV show, you knew the beginning.
Yeah.
And that was it. And so, you know, this was kind of like making a big 5-hour movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, and it sounds like the way it was shot, too. You sort of have to think of it as a movie. Otherwise, trying to piece together, okay, this is a scene now we're doing from episode 8, and now we're going to shoot something from episode 2. And how do you kind of keep track of your character's emotions and where he's at in the course of the season?
Yeah, there was definitely some jigsaw puzzle aspects to it. And there was at least a couple of times where, Pete Farrelly and Bobby Mort and I and the first AD would be standing in a circle going, okay, so is this – wait a minute. Is this before or after such and such?
Yeah.
And you could look around and you'd see that nobody knew the answer. You know, we all knew that we needed to know the answer. But
yeah,
every once in a while there was something that just kind of stumped everybody. And then we had to go look it up.
Yeah, yeah. But – nonetheless, you pulled it off.
Yeah, we did it.
When did you shoot season 2?
Season 2 we did in July and August of this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's quick.
Yeah.
It's a lot quicker. In fact, I think they're still doing post on the last 3 episodes.
I was going to say that is a quick turnaround. And so that was sort of in between also doing the pilot to A Million Little Things and now shooting that series.
Yes.
So
it was the pilot I did back in the late spring, and I was shooting concurrently with – I was doing Loudermilk, A Million Little Things. Oh, they both shot in Vancouver, So I, you know, was able to kind of go back and forth between those two things.
Yeah.
It was a busy couple months.
I bet. Do you enjoy that? Sort of. Is it tough to sort of get out of one character's head and into another character's head, and then vice versa when you're doing it simultaneously?
Not really. I mean, there were a lot of lines to learn. That, you know, that was there was a lot of work to be done. But I like working.
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
jobs are good. Yeah.
Yeah. Actors, we tend to like working better than not working.
Right.
So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool. And so, Loudermilk, you know, obviously there's a, you know, your character has gone through a lot, but he goes through a lot at the end of season one, and he's still sort of dealing with the ramifications of his friendship and the destruction of that friendship to some degree. But it also seems to have given him a new ambition in season two to take charge of his life, get back to writing, and he seems to be on a much better path. Where would you say Loudermilk is as we enter season two?
Yeah, I think we blew up his life in season one, and kind of took away everything that he had taken for granted. And I think when that happens, there's a freedom as you start putting it back together again, of saying, well, let's put it back together, you know, a little better. So I feel like a lot of season two is about him finally coming around to trying to tackle some of the bigger things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, why doesn't he write anymore? He's got to get into issues of family.
Yeah.
He's got to, you know, figure out what his, you know, relationship with Allison is, what his relationship with Ben is. You know, and he's still the same guy. He's the biggest a-hole in the world, and he wakes up miserable every day and takes it out on everybody, and just wants to get through the day sober, and you know, and then he's back at it again the next day, and it's a lot of fun to do. It allows us to go a lot of different places, but yeah, we're going to see him squirm this season.
We didn't think it was true that you were running a meeting out of a record store or closet.
Well, I'm glad you're here now. How's everybody doing?
Yeah, hi.
Wow, I have chills from that wave of excitement coming at me. Why'd you move?
Me? What about you? You disappeared.
I was just giving you some space.
It's been a month.
It's a month and 2 days. I don't forget anniversaries.
It's over. She's back with that clown, the doctor.
What kind of a woman goes with the man who has the money, the security, the looks, the future, instead of going with the floor cleaner who runs a rehab in a record store closet?
I'm a critic with an impeccable reputation. I'm a published author.
I'm somebody.
Ish.
Won't you help me sober up?
You gotta learn to let things go and forgive.
I'm very sorry that I married your ex-wife.
Grovel somewhere else, fatty.
Loudermilk has got nowhere to go.
How'd you know where I was?
One of the group guys saw you.
You're coming to my meetings.
Let's get the band back together and go back to the church.
You slip up.
Just one time, I swear I will burn this church down and join a satanic cult.
So we're in.
Yeah. Well, you say he's the biggest a-hole in the world, but yet we also see he's got this true moral compass, which, you know, he's presented, for example, I've seen the first three episodes, so I don't know where it goes mm-hmm. from there. But, you know, he's presented with a situation with, you know, one of the people in his group who reveals a secret, and a lot of people in the group are like, just let's let it lie. Let's just not deal with this. Let's not, you know, report this at all. And Loudermilk reports it. He sort of takes the moral high ground, which, you know, I found myself actually saying, don't do it, Loudermilk. Like, yeah. why are you complicating things? Just let it go. There was a solution here, and now you've blown it up. Talk about that dichotomy of him being an asshole, but yet sort of being the most moral guy in the room.
You know, it's there's the one thing that Loudermilk knows is that, you know, you got to work the steps. And I think anybody that's had experience with, you know, recovery, it's. To do that, you have to just be brutally honest with yourself, do an inventory of yourself, and you know, call him like you see him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about him that he's – that's kind of how he's wired anyway. That's how he was when he was a music critic. He doesn't care what people think of him. He can't help but be brutally honest. And so I think in that situation, it just comes down to, you know, it's not even like he's doing the right thing. It's like he knows what this kid needs to do. Mm-hmm. And he can't not tell him to do that, you know. And I'll give you a great story because I love that episode. I love that scene. And this is – it's kind of a little bit about how Pete Farrelly and Bobby Farrelly work. The kid that that does that, Deacon Moon, was on the show all last year as a background artist sitting in the circle in the church basement.
Uh-huh.
No lines. Wasn't really an actor. He's been doing background work for, I think, 15 years. And never had a speaking part.
Yeah.
And when this part came along, Pete was sort of like, "Well, it feels really weird to have this part. And all of a sudden, a new guy's gonna show up, and then turn out to, you know, have this storyline, and it seems kind of convenient." And so he took a flyer on Deacon, and Deacon parked it.
Yeah.
He just knocked it out of the park. It was like – it was astonishing. But that's the kind of – those are the kind of like chances. You know, that's how Pete Farrelly works.
Yeah.
That's how Bobby Farrelly works. They like to bet on people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You're right. That's a payoff. And you know, when everyone else in the group says he's never spoke before, like, that's literally true.
We got to actually have a little fun about the fact of, like, this guy's been sitting here for a year and we haven't ever said hello to him or know who he is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And he comes through and yeah, that's fascinating. Peter Farrelly, by the way, he's got like this Oscar contender movie now too.
I can't wait to see it.
As he's heading in the drama, you know, he's doing TV now. He's doing drama. It's been fascinating to see his career progress. You know, given that he's been a superstar director for so many years, and he's still trying new things.
Yeah, he's a storyteller. I think that's the thing about Pete is he's a great storyteller, and he trusts his instincts. He's a little mischievous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I know when you say mischievous, it sounds like somebody's 12, but he has a little bit of that, like, little kid, you know? He likes to push buttons a little bit, and not in a mean-spirited way, but he just kind of likes to see what he can get away with. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you know, he would make a terrific movie.
No, and again, looking at, you know, all the things that you're in right now, you know, one sort of through line is, you know, Louder Milk obviously deals with addiction issues, and Million Little Things deals a lot with mental health.
Yes.
And, you know, both cases, it's, you know, not heavy-handed. Neither show is really trying to beat you over the head with these things. But nonetheless, these are shows that are dealing with some pretty heavy subjects. What's your take on TV and sort of, you know, how it should address these kind of issues and how it does do that?
You know, I feel like you want to do it. You want to do it. There's a way to do it responsibly. The main thing you have to do is you have to be honest about it and authentic about it, and you have to be compelling. There has to be a reason it's in there. If you're just kind of putting it in there so that, you know, you can wear a ribbon and have a poster, it's not going to work, and people aren't going to buy it, and they're going to be offended by it.
Yeah.
To me, at the kind of the through line, and really it kind of even Office Space is a little similar. Both of these characters I'm doing right now, Louder Milk, the comedy, the half hour comedy, and Million Little Things, the 1 hour drama. They're kind of about people who are miserable, trying to get through the day.
Yeah.
And it's really about that struggle. And I think, you know, the difference is Peter Gibbons eventually gives himself permission to just be happy. Louder Milk can't give himself the permission to just be happy. He can't seem to ever be anything but miserable. And John Dixon on A Million Little Things gives up altogether. So, you know, it's – but I think there's something about all of those things that appeals to me to explore.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's relatable in a way that people will either get something out of it or at least enjoy watching it, or at the very least, you know, won't hurt them.
How much do you know about the Million Little Things backstory? Has DJ Nash given you?
I know more than you.
Yeah.
But probably not much more than you.
Yeah.
DJ likes to work on a need to know basis, so he's completely forthcoming on all of the details that pertain to whatever particular scene that we're shooting at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also great about, he doesn't want to dole out information. So a lot of the actors know specific things, and that's information that the other actors don't know.
Are you guys preparing or comparing notes or?
No, I think. Well, maybe some people are. I think it's a good way to work, and it's part of the fun of it. You know, and truth be told, even if he does tell me that something's true, that doesn't mean he can't change it a couple episodes later and flip it and find out, oh, no, that wasn't true.
Yeah.
So it does, I think, preserve a lot of freedom for him to be able to take the show where he wants to take it.
Let me ask you one more question about Loudermilk, and then we'll get to your favorite episode question. But the relationship between him and Ben.
Yeah.
Again, I've only seen the first couple of episodes. I feel like this is a friendship that, you know, needs to be salvaged, and it will be at some point. But what do you make of that, and how tough will it be for Loudermilk to, regain that friendship and that trust in his former best friend?
Well, it's funny. The Loudermilk-Ben relationship is... you know how there's a bromance?
Yeah.
This is like an old bro married couple.
Yeah.
That squabbles at each other constantly, but you know, they just need each other.
Yeah.
And in a really fun way, it's like they got a divorce at the end of the last season, and now we're exes basically that. On the outs, and it's kind of funny to see two, you know, sort of middle-aged guys, basically, or at least this one is. I won't pin that on Will. behaving that way, the way that you would sort of expect, an old married
right.
couple to be.
Yeah.
But it is a big. I mean, that Ben was his sponsor. Ben was his kind of best / only friend, his roommate, and his rock, kind of the anchor, the person that first helped him get him on the path to get clean. So it's he's gonna Loudermilk's a little bit out in the wind without Ben, and I don't know, it's very funny.
Yeah.
Ben does come back. He comes back around eventually, and I won't give it away, but it's not easy. It's not
yeah.
quick. Oh, here we're back.
Right, right. Because it is truly the real love affair of this series, and it's heartbreaking to see those two on the outs. But that's
heartbreaking and really funny.
And exactly,
seeing them. There's a little punch in Judy.
Yeah.
To it too. That's kind of fun to watch.
It's what drives the show, definitely. Well, Ron, thanks for stopping by. Congrats on, dominating all three platforms. And we'll look forward to seeing what's next.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Anything in particular you're excited about that you can talk about? Or
I've got a couple of films in the can that are coming out, but I don't really know the calendar when they're going to be. And,
yeah.
And they change titles so often that I hesitate to even say the name.
Put the thing
on. I will say one. Yeah. There's a film called The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot, which I signed on to on the title, on the basis
yeah.
of the title alone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And Sam Elliott is in it, so how do you say no to that?
Sam Elliott having another moment right now, too. So.
But that's probably the best title that I
saw that on your IMDb, and I'm like, what is that?
Right.
Like, is that real?
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
What are you playing that?
I come in and I play government, like a government agent.
But
yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled. I thought you were going to tell me you play Hitler, but
no, not in this one.
All right. Well, thanks, Ron. Thanks for stopping by. Great talking to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.